the Einstein field equations.
So generalized harmonic coordinates, this generalized harmonic form begins with what is called generalized harmonic coordinates, harmonic coordinates, which we'll generalize. So harmonic coordinates is a condition that you impose on the metric. So it's a choice of coordinates where you demand that each space-time coordinate satisfies a covariant wave equation. Right, so here I'm going to, I think x alpha is, you know, whatever, how many dimensions you have, time, space. And so what you, so this sounds, this looks kind of strange saying that a coordinate satisfies a wave equation, but this is just some condition that we can, well, let's assume that we have chosen coordinates where this is the case. So for example, you know, if we had, let's just say x alpha equals, you know, t, x, y, z, these are our coordinates. And this would be the set of four conditions that box t 0, box x equals 0, etc. Right, and box is the usual wave operator. So written in terms of ordinary derivatives, it's the following. So let's say box acting on some scalar function x is the following. So, you know, in a very schematic way, if you think, we have in four dimensions, we have four coordinates, so we have 4 degrees of freedom to choose. This is a choice of coordinates. We have four conditions on the coordinates. Just have to do this. Given by these conditions. Now again, this might seem strange, and I don't really have a very good sort of intuitive explanation for what harmonic coordinates are, other than you can perhaps imagine, well, because these coordinates satisfy a wave equation, let's imagine, you know, a metric in some arbitrary coordinates, and well, let's say what would be a harmonic version of that metric. You can sort of imagine that those coordinates are waves that propagate on some background metric. But that's not a very good, even that's not a very good description. I mean, the utility of harmonic coordinates will become clear when we see, well, what does that do to the Einstein field equations? Okay. Now, actually, I mean, harmonic coordinates are very old in relativity. They've been around, and in fact, even since before Einstein came up with the field equation. So in some of his old notebooks, when he was trying to come up with the equations, he was experimenting in various forms of sort of approximations, linearized versions of what eventually were the field equations. And even I think as early as 1910, there's some notes where he used these coordinate conditions. I think at the time he called them isothermal conditions, but they've come to be called harmonic coordinates. And they were instrumental in the 60s when Yvonne Choquet proved the first existence and uniqueness theorems of the field equations using these coordinates. And we'll sort of see why in the end when we rewrite the Einstein equations using these coordinates and what it does to the field equations. So if you impose these conditions, you've sort of used up your coordinate degrees of freedom, you made a choice of the representation of the metric. But now generalized harmonic coordinates is similar to this, but instead of saying that each coordinate satisfies a homogeneous wave equation, you add a source function to the right-hand side. Now that's all generalized harmonic coordinates are, at least in as a coordinate choice. So you say, now let each space-time satisfy a wave equation with the source. So these functions, these can depend on your coordinates. You can think of them either as a set of scalar source functions. So if we enforce space-time dimensions, we have four coordinates, so there are four source functions that we can choose. And that's the way that we're going to be using these when we manipulate the field equations, or as a vector-like quantity. And I guess the important thing is it's vector-like. This is not a vector in the usual sense of the word. If you define a vector in terms of how it transforms under coordinate transformations, it's not a traditional vector. Let's go over here. On the other hand, we can definitely treat it as a vector when we do tensor manipulations. We can raise and lower with a metric. We can take derivatives of this, and we will do that. And so it's much more convenient to think of this as a vector as opposed to a set of scalar functions. But the way to see that it's not a traditional vector is, so it's not a traditional vector. So instead it transforms like the trace of the connection under coordinate transformations. So the connection, the Christoffel symbols, we treat them in the same way as we do this object. So it's not a rank 3 tensor in the usual sense of the word, but we can still treat it as a tensor-like object. We can raise and lower, we can differentiate, etc. It's just that the usual rules for transforming the tensor from one representation to another is a bit different. And if you wanted to, how you can see this explicitly is just using the definition of this operator, the scalar operator, together with the identity. So I guess from the definition of box and using the identity, that the trace of the connection is equal to, next line is a logarithmic gradient of the determinant of the metric. One can show that so now I'm going to define again just. Right, so we're just going to raise and lower indices of this object using the metric like before. And from this, we can show that H alpha is equal to minus so this is just what this function is. And so, of course, this is a proper tensor, this isn't, and so this is going to determine how it transforms under coordinate transformations. Okay. So just to sort of be clear, when we write out the field equations, you're going to be introducing gradients of this quantity, and you think, well, okay, if it's a set of scalar quantities, it's not a scalar under coordinate transformations. It's not a vector. It transforms like this, but it's perfectly fine to treat it as a tensor-like object when we manipulate the field equations. Now, one other comment before we do that is, and this is the reason for using generalized harmonic coordinates as opposed to just plain harmonic coordinates, is with harmonic coordinates above, you can think of that as having fixed our coordinate degrees of freedom. It's a specific choice about the representation for the metric. On the other hand, with generalized harmonic coordinates, In some sense, we still have all of our coordinate degrees of freedom. We've just shoved them into these source functions, G. In other words, any metric in any coordinate system can be written in generalized harmonic form. And it's sort of straightforward to see that. Your comments in the any metric. Any coordinate system. Can be written in generalized harmonic form. And it's trivial to see what the corresponding source functions are. So you give me one of your favorite metric and your favorite coordinate system and just evaluate this operator. And this will give you what the corresponding source functions are. So, of course, when we get to sort of a numerical evolution where we don't a priori know what this metric is, then it's a more challenging problem in the sense that we'll have to give equations that evolve this along with the space-time. But what this is supposed to show you is that if we introduce these source functions, we aren't using up our coordinate degrees of freedom. This is a completely general way of writing the field equations in any coordinate system that we want. Okay, so now to see what the utility of this in rewriting the field equations, we're going to start with field equations. And now we're going to expand the Ricci tensor and then try to make use of this. Well, first we'll just write out explicitly what the field equations are in terms of the metric, show that it's not a nice operator, or doesn't have any definite character in any sense. It's not hyperbolic, parabolic, or elliptic. And then we'll see what this condition or how we can use that to sort of fix the character to make it manifestly hyperbolic. Whoops, missed the Ricci scalar. So the easiest way to do this is actually to use the trace reversed form of the field equations. And that's just saying, well, let's take the trace of this equation so we can solve for R as a function of T, the trace of the stress tensor. And then we substitute it back there, so we'll get T instead of R, and we move it to the right-hand side. So if you do that OR in trace reversed form. Field equations. And so it doesn't really matter, but it's just convenient in the sense that the left-hand side, the geometry, is now just encoded by the Ricci tensor, and then the stress tensor for matter, all that stuff's on the right-hand side. Okay, so this is broken, right? So I'm going to use. Did it just break, or did he actually write up there? Oh, okay, the mid one. Oh, that's the front one is broken and the rear one, but the mid one is working. Okay, that's good. Okay, so let me just sort of outline the steps. I mean, this is basically just algebra now. So first,
to write the Ricci tensor in terms of the connection, just to remind you. I think I've got all these indices correctly, but this is just something you can just look up in any textbook. And yeah, by comma, I'm just using a notation ordinary derivative. So this is just the ordinary derivative. Oops, that was the same thing. And recall that the connection is just in terms of the metric. So to get the field equations into the metric, which is what we want, we just substitute the connection into this expression for the Riemann tensor, and we get the field equations in the following form. Or let's just, the left-hand side, that's the only that we're interested. And so we get, we write it in two lines. For the first line is going to be the principal part of the field equation. So from a differential equations perspective, the principal part of a differential operator. So you can think of the left-hand side, this is being a differential operator acting on the metric. And the principal part that determines the character of the equations is the highest derivatives that appear. So in this case, that's all the second derivative terms of the metric are going to define the principal part of the equations. And so that's the following. And again, where logarithms of determinants of metrics come in is by applying this identity. When they're traces of the connection, then you can replace it with terms like this. So this is the first line, this is the principal part. And notice that the principal part is linear. Well, in particular, if we expanded this out in terms of the metric, in some sense it's linear, whereas all the sort of the non-linearity, sort of squares of derivatives terms show up in the lower order terms, which are as follows. Okay, so a lot of symbols, but again, the particular form doesn't matter, except the two things that I wanted to stress first is separating it out into the principal parts and the lower order terms. So it's a principal part that determines
the character, in quotes, of the differential equations. So if you look at the principal parts here, so let's just say pick alpha and beta, so pick one of these equations. We can see that this term, so this gives us the alpha and beta, the particular element of the metric that we're operating on. This is just the leading order part of the wave operator box. So this term is just the wave operator. So the wave operator, so a wave equation, that is a nice mathematical character. That's a hyperbolic equation. So if it were only this, things would be fine. But now you can see that there are these other terms that come in here, which essentially changes it from being a wave operator. And if you did go and try to analyze the structure of this, there is really no character to the equation. It's not hyperbolic, it's not parabolic, it's not elliptic. And it shouldn't be, because we know that we can take any physical geometry and write it in any coordinate system we want. And we can choose coordinates that, you know, are as nice as we want or as pathological as we want. And, you know, in terms of the Ricci tensor, they shouldn't be hyperbolic, elliptic, or parabolic. It's only once we choose coordinates. So any form that we write the field equation solves the Einstein equations, and so there really isn't a definite character until we choose, we fix the coordinates. So this is just, this is why, you know, it took so long for people to, or Yvonne Choquet originally in the 60s, actually prove well-posedness and existence of solutions of the field equations, because, you know, at least at face value, if you just write them out naively like this, they don't make any sense mathematically. So now what we're going to do with our harmonic coordinates is we're going to take this definition, and actually its gradient, and we'll just write out what the gradient is, and we'll see that using that, we'll actually be able to replace these terms, substitute them in terms of functions of the source function. So let's just consider this object. So the symmetric gradient of the source function. And it's just, you know, essentially just from the definition. So it's a couple of lines of algebra, which I just won't write down here because it's straightforward to show, but essentially from the definition, we can show that this object is equal to make sure that I've got all the indices right here. So there's nothing complicated other than just taking the definition, doing the symmetric derivative, and seeing what you get. But what you can see, just comparing it directly to this, is that this, let's say star, is just, oops, like, I shouldn't have. It's exactly minus this. It's minus this. This is minus star above. And this This is just lower order terms. So if we just take this, if you will, this identity, this is just the definition of what this thing is in terms of the metric, we can eliminate those two sets of principal terms in favor of this symmetric gradient plus lower order terms, and these lower order terms will then just go to the second line. So substitute this into the left-hand side, and then we get the Einstein field equations in generalized harmonic form. Let me start at the top again. Might as well. Okay, so let me just can write it out. It's basically the same as the other one, just for completeness. So this is the field equations in generalized harmonic form. And again, this is the principal parts. The lower order terms next. And yeah, just for notational convenience, I'm just replacing those things with the Christoffels again, because these are just first gradients of the metric. And then this equals, is coupled to the stress tensor of the matter. Okay, so at this stage, we really haven't done anything different. We've just rewritten the equations in terms of by defining this quantity, this H alpha, we call them source functions. So in some sense, you can think of it, we've just defined this quantity, and we've just rewritten the field equations in terms of this quantity. So no big deal. But now the trick is for the generalized harmonic form, is we're going to treat these as independent functions. So you can think of them as being the choice of gauge. So for example, we can say, well, let's choose harmonic coordinates. Let's choose coordinates such that the h's are zero. Well, then these terms vanish, and you can see this becomes a principal part of the field equations, and the principal part is then just the wave operator. So it's manifestly hyperbolic, and so that was sort of the starting point for the proof of, you know, existence and uniqueness, because then you can just take standard theorems from PDEs that work on hyperbolic equations to show that, you know, at least in a vicinity of some Cauchy slice, you can get a unique solution. But we don't want to necessarily choose harmonic coordinates, because they might not be globally well-defined. We still want our coordinate degrees of freedom. So we're not going to set them to zero, but we're going to treat them as independent functions. At the first glance, it might sound that it's almost too good to be true. It's like we're doing something that we shouldn't be. It's like magic, you know. And in some sense,
It is. So we're going to consider these as independent. So what that means from a differential equations point of view is that we need additional equations or conditions, but in general equations that determine the source function. So for example, one, we can choose harmonic or something else. We can have some differential operator acting on them, equal zero, etc. So what we really have in generalized harmonic evolution is we have an expanded system of equations. We have 10 equations, so in four dimensions, there are 10 independent, non-trivial components of the matrix. So this is a set of 10 wave-like equations. And then we need an extra four equations to complete the specification of the system, plus whatever additional equations we want for the matter. So in some sense, we've expanded the class of solutions that we can get so that we can get a well-posed system of equations. The seems sort of like magic. Now suddenly we've considered these as independent source functions. You might say, well, why does considering something actually change anything? Well, the reason why we can do this is now we do have a larger class of solutions possible to these equations, and we don't want all of these solutions, right? So the price or the price that you have to pay is, in the end, we're only interested in the subset of solutions to this expanded system of equations that satisfies this constraint. Interested solutions to, let's call this, so the field equations A and whatever additional equations we specify to this. So we're only interested in the subset of solutions to the system of equations A and B that satisfy what is now a constraint. Let me write it in this form. So I'm just defining this object C alpha to be and so we're only interested in solutions where this is exactly equal to zero. So if I just gave you this system of equations plus whatever set of equations here, you can get a whole class of solutions that don't satisfy this condition. We're not interested in those. We just want the ones where the constraints are zero. Whoops, and I messed up the order of the boards, but I'll just go here then. Okay, so what are these constraints? Of course, this is exactly what they are. But how do they relate to the sort of more traditional constraints in the ADM formalism, the Hamiltonian, the momentum constraint? They're actually quite closely related. Because if you look at, again, just look at this from the perspective of differential equations. This is a set of second-order partial differential equations for the metric. They're wave-like equations. So if you want a solution, you need to specify G at some... So you choose a coordinate system where T is a constant, is a well-defined space-like slice.
So at t equals 0, you've got to choose g and dg dt. And then you evolve it forward with a system of equations. And at least just from this by itself, you can freely specify g and g dot. But of course, it's not free, because if you expand what this really is in terms of g's, you'll find out that g and g dot appear in here. So you're not free to specify g and g dot. But it turns out that if you choose initial conditions, sort of a g and g dot that satisfy the traditional Hamiltonian momentum constraints, they will automatically satisfy c equals 0 and c dot equal to 0, which is important. Okay. So let me. Okay. So the traditional Hamiltonian momentum constraints can be written as follows. Hamiltonian So we've just defined this object M, which is the field equations, multiplied by a unit normal vector, in alpha here is just units time-like vector. Normal to our t equals constant slices. So with the 3 plus 1 formulas, I mean, even this harmonic form, so the harmonic form, we're not going to decompose it into lapse and shift and spatial metric. We're always keeping the 4 metric. But when we want to evolve this, we're still thinking of it as a Cauchy problem, where we choose a time slice. We start at t equals 0, and we want to evolve forwards. So given the time slice t equals 0, some t equals constant, that defines a vector that's orthogonal to that time slice. And if you take that vector, you construct this operator, then essentially this is the Hamiltonian constraint. And the spatial projection of this, so if you will, the time component of this is the Hamiltonian constraint. And I just write it as the projection operator. So I guess Luis did introduce this projection operator too. So the projection that's orthogonal to this normal. And these are the momentum constraints. And one can show that the traditional constraints, the M's, are related to the harmonic constraints C by the following relation. This is the covariant gradient operator. From this expression, you see, if we choose initial conditions such that the momentum and Hamiltonian constraints are satisfied, in other words, M is 0, that is equivalent to choosing initial conditions where C is 0. So this is just, so you can think of this sort of the spatial gradient of C, but that C is zero, and this is in some sense the time derivative of C. So choosing G alpha beta at t equals zero, and the time derivative such that this is equivalent to saying choosing C alpha at t equals zero, and so the harmonic constraints are, you know, in some sense just the traditional constraints. And this is actually very useful for a numerical evolution, because if you actually were to write out these conditions and we say, well, let's try to solve these equations. So we want to choose initial conditions for some evolution that's consistent with the constraints in whatever form. In this form, these aren't very nice equations to deal with. On the other hand, in this form, you can manipulate them or you can rewrite them in a way where, again, this is not a trivial thing to solve. So I don't know into how much detail Luis went with the initial data problem. But you know, essentially, since the 70s, a lot of work has been done by York and Lichnerowitz and various people to come up with very well-motivated prescriptions for solving these constraints. So to come up with a set of elliptic equations where you can relatively straightforwardly solve the constraints. So the nice thing, the practical thing that's nice with generalized harmonic evolution, you don't have to worry about this. You can use all the technology that's been developed to solve these constraints, and then that will just give you consistent initial data that's what's automatically consistent with the harmonic constraints. Okay. For time. So a few minutes left, so let me just finish with one important comment. Okay, so to sort of summarize, in some sense, what we want to do with this generalized harmonic evolution. So we want to given a metric and its first time derivative at t equals to zero that satisfies, let's call this set of equations, let's label them C. Right. We want to solve this. We want the metric for all time using A and B. So the Einstein equations and whatever equations we want to have for the source functions, harmonic condition, etc. So that's the approach. That's how you solve the field equation in this harmonic form. You solve the constraints, you find your initial values, and then you evolve these forward as a set of wave equations plus whatever conditions you want for the metric. So, but again, we're not interested in solutions to this expanded system. We're only interested in solutions to the Einstein equations that solve these equations plus these constraints. But if we only evolve these, we're not touching the constraints. So the important question is, if we did this, so we pick g and g dot that's consistent with the constraints at t equals zero, and then we evolve for g to the future using
just the evolution equations. So is this, will this give a solution that satisfies the constraints equal to zero for all time? And the base is sort of in, and the answer is yes. And the proof is if you, and I'm not going to derive this, but I'll just show you the reason for that, at least at the analytic level. And so from the definition of this constraint quantity, the C alpha, and using the contracted Bianchi identities, you can actually come up with a propagation equation for the constraints. And so this is just, this is putting quotes here, the proof. So using the Einstein field equations, plus you'll need to use the contracted Bianchi identities. One can show the following, that the constraints satisfy the following homogeneous wave equation. Oops. That's the next step. And so, from the structure of this equation, so this is now also just a wave equation, a simple wave equation. So you can see if we start with a solution, so if you wanted, let's imagine we wanted to solve this equation, what are the kinds of solutions that this equation will have? Well, if we start with initial conditions where both C and its first time derivative are zero, and we have boundary conditions that are consistent with C being zero, then this says C will be zero for all time, just from the nature of this equation. So given proper boundary conditions. So this equation says it'll be zero for all time. And so this at least at the analytic level says that this procedure for writing the Einstein equation, so introducing these source functions, promoting them to the status of independent functions, introducing additional equations for them, but choosing initial conditions where it's consistent with our constraints that they're not really independent functions. This says that we will get a solution to the field equations, at least analytically. Now, the problem is, so I'll just finish with this last comment, this is what Luis will talk about on Thursday, is of course when we try to solve the system of equations numerically, we never solve this. We solve the Einstein equations, and this will hold, but this will only hold up to truncation error. So if you say, well, if you look at the numeric version of this, however you discretize the field equations, finite difference, spectral, etc., the numeric version, there's going to be some discrete operator. And this is going to be some discretized, let's call them hats, version of the metric. And then there are going to be truncation error terms that are going to come here. So even if you start with initial conditions where this is satisfied to machine roundoff, you're going to get truncation error source terms. And the big question is, well, how does this affect the evolution of the system? And, you know, at least naively, that shouldn't be a problem. We only ever solve the equations to within truncation error. So if this is zero to within truncation error, that shouldn't be a problem. The only problem is if this can grow exponentially in time. It's still, you know, the code will still be convergent. It's still an acceptable way of solving it. But if it grows exponentially, what that implies is you need impractical resolution. It'll be impractical both in the
the number of decimals that you'd need to start with. So you need to satisfy this to zero to within many, many decimals, so such that by the time that you're interested in getting a solution, you want to solve the system for some physical amount of time, that this has not grown to a point where it's adversely affecting your solution. And it turns out that this, that at least in this form of the equations, it admits exponentially growing modes. So it's not well behaved in that sense. And so what Luis will talk about on Thursday is a few extra terms that we can add to the equations that change the character of this in such a way that this is not just a homogeneous wave equation, but there's a damping term. It becomes a damped wave equation. So even if you start with some source, it tends to want to damp it away. Okay, any questions? Okay, so what we'll do tomorrow is we'll start with the field equations in harmonic form, actually. And from there, it's quite a straightforward to go to the linearized field equations in a harmonic gauge and then restrict it to transverse traceless and to come up with the standard textbook result that there are two polarizations, the plus and the cross, for linearized gravitational waves. Okay, thank you. Yeah.